Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Number 187 from the recorded sayings of Master Joshu. A monk asked, "What is the unmistaken path?" The master said, "Awakening your mind, seeing your nature. These are the unmistaken path." I could just stop there. I think that sums it up. But maybe I'll say a few words. And first, I'd like to say a big thank you for all of you for being here, for supporting this practice, for all the details that go into a session like this. It astounds me how much goes into something like this, and I'm incredibly grateful. You can take a moment to turn if you like. This may be a short talk, so you don't have to, but you can feel free to turn. A teacher that I know once said, "Don't be a victim of Zen." So if you need to turn, if you need to move, that's okay. Maybe it'll make me a little less nervous, you know, seeing faces and interacting with people a little bit. So first things first, I've been told over the years I have an accent. So if I say something that you don't understand, or if I use some words or lingo you don't understand, ask me and I'll translate. And I'll try not to use y'all too many times for the next few minutes. When I was first asked about doing this talk, I was very excited, then somewhat nervously excited. Then it became daunting and nervous, in that I thought, what do I have to offer? You'll find out, I'm just a regular guy. I think people come to talk sometimes to come away with something very profound, some great pearls of wisdom, some great something you can really sink your teeth in when you leave. And we'll see if that happens. I'm not too sure about that. But I often wondered, what do I have to offer? I'm not the most articulate person in the world, I don't think. And I'm certainly not somebody with a great amount of finesse. You'll see me bumbling along, doing my work, bumbling along, being the assistant to Jisha. I'm just a regular guy. According to the itinerary, I'm Shindo Zenji. During the day, I'm known as Tim, who happens to be an occupational therapist for some 34 years, I believe. Retired once, but back at work again about 4 days a week. And I think because there were days where I was wondering what I was going to do, and then there were days I felt like I was just kind of wasting my life. And maybe what few skills I have or that I've gained over the years, I felt like I was wasting that. So I find myself working 4 days a week after retirement. But I feel very fortunate to work in a profession that allows me to help others. It somehow I found this profession, and everything just merged. A little bit of a dry mouth too, but everything just merged. My personality, what amount of intellect I might have, how I interact with people, it all just merged into this profession. And I feel incredibly fortunate in that I'm able to help people that are in an incredibly difficult place in their life, very vulnerable. I work a lot with people who've had strokes and brain injury, upper extremity injuries. So I really get to kind of embody, I suppose, this idea of right livelihood, which kind of contrasts with a former life of mine of being in the military for a few years, out of high school before I went to college. I kind of kid myself sometimes that tell myself that I'm better at helping people than I am at hurting people. So I somehow made my way to being a therapist. My Zen path, my practice path, has been almost as long as my career as an occupational therapist. I took precepts in Jikai ceremony with a different teacher than this lineage. And some years later, I was ordained in a ceremony with Gente Sandy Stewart Osho from the North Carolina Zen Center, who happens to be a peer, I guess this would be a correct way of saying it, he's a peer Osho of Chigan Roshi. So both Gente and then Dokuro were ordained by Joshu Sasaki Roshi. And Gente still teaches, but not in a formal sense. He was the abbot of the North Carolina Zen Center and retired in 2015. And now the center, which is just a few miles down from my road, from my house, just a few miles down the road, is a different lineage. It's a different teacher. And so after Gente left, I stayed for a couple of months, kept things going, and then the board decided to go a different direction. So I still practice with Gente, but I have kind of followed along the way of Chigan Roshi after Sasaki Roshi stopped teaching. And Chigan Roshi was a great support of mine when we had this tumultuous time at the Zen Center when the board of directors shifted directions completely. And many of us were really struggling. And I was one of those struggling quite a bit. So somehow or another, I found my way to Daibosatsu. And actually, the first time I came to Daibosatsu was during a Nyogen Senzaki Sesshin. So this Sesshin has great importance to me. The first time I came was during this time of year, some time ago. And now this one is the first time back since the pandemic. So I haven't been up here, 3 years maybe, something like that. So I'm still settling in myself. I'm still a bit rusty. But the thing about Nyogen Senzaki, and I do not claim to be a biographer by any stretch, I've probably read the same material that all of you have about Nyogen Senzaki. But to me, he represents the Bodhisattva ideal. If you read his information, you can easily see that he was a great man of great humility. He didn't have a title. He didn't have a role. He didn't have a permanent zendo. He had what he called a floating zendo, went from place to place. And kind of ironically, I find myself doing that now in our local sangha. But he didn't even advertise, I don't think, about his practice. He grew his hair out. He didn't wear robes. I think he wore a roksu or a suit, maybe, business suit. So a man of great humility. The other thing that really resonates with me is that he was a man of great perseverance and commitment. And I can only imagine if you think about the story of him coming to America, and long story short, his teacher leaving, he was told not to teach. One account I read 17 years, one account I read 20 years. And he struggled financially. I can only imagine him struggling from a relationship standpoint, not knowing people here, or maybe a handful, but not many. And then, of course, being sent to the Japanese internment camp during World War II, and then getting out and resuming practice. So, to me, he represents kind of the bodhisattva, I suppose, that I strive to be. Yeah. So what is it that he and I and all of us have in common? And I think it's pretty simple. We're all human. We all experience these human conditions of joy, happiness, sadness, grief. And if we're sitting here today, then we put some weight into the Buddha's original teachings of the Four Noble Truths. If you live, you're going to have suffering. So I think that at a most basic level is what we all have in common. And I don't want to be morbid, but I've been reflecting on suffering quite a bit lately. I have elderly parents that are aging. I'm no spring chicken, you know. I can feel the aging myself. Still working with people that have an incredible amount of suffering. There's one I mentioned. But I'm also involved in this training program currently. And I think by virtue of that, we look at suffering. Now, I've come to use a different word. I've come to use the word distress. Suffering for me tends to go from 0 to 100 in the sense that I grew up Southern Baptist. And so the idea of suffering was going to hell. A literal lake of fire and gnashing like Dante's Inferno or something. Scared the bejesus out of it, you know. But suffering doesn't always have to be the worst case scenario. Suffering can be relative, I think. If your body aches and you're having a hard go of it, well, that's suffering. If you're having if you've been in a car accident and you have multiple trauma, that's suffering, maybe on a different level than the, you know, my knees are hurting. I remember some 20 plus years ago, I went through a divorce. It was pretty rough. And so I'd go to work and I'd be wondering about, oh, you know, all the things you worry about when you're having a divorce. I don't have kids, so that wasn't in the equation. But selling your house, what happened, you know, your mind goes in those kinds of places. What went wrong? What did I do? And so I go to work, and I remember distinctly that long ago, having a rough morning. And I was going down the hallway to work with a patient who was quadriplegic. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, here I am, you know, woe is me, and this guy can barely feed himself. Not to mention he couldn't dress himself. Bowel and bladder, that's a whole therapy kind of thing. I don't know, won't get into. you know, and I was like, yes, my pain is real. But it's not on that same level. So, you know, mental pain can be, gosh, anything that any of you might be experiencing over the 1 day of the 5 days. gosh, I can't seem to get anything right. I keep messing up. Why can't I ever do anything like I'm supposed to? You know, all those kinds of things that goes through your mind, ruminating over bad memories and things like that. That's suffering. Is it the same suffering as having lost a family member and thinking about that? And so there's no real comparison there. It's all suffering, different levels. Some it's kind of just really gnaws at you. And then some of it you can kind of take with a grain of salt and kind of keep moving. And I think that leads me to another reflection I had when I was kind of chewing on suffering a little bit. And so I thought, well, I've heard many times, and I've said it myself, when it comes to this practice, just don't get stuck. Keep going. Just don't get stuck. I think we all have this, at least I do, this visualization of a truck being stuck. You just can't go anywhere. But then I was thinking, well, if everything changes, nothing is permanent, then suffering is impermanent. Whether you do anything about it or not, suffering will just go away. So we're not really going to get stuck at all. But then that's not the way I look at it. I look at suffering as, yes, it will go away, but what do we do with the suffering? How do we shape it? How do we work with it? How do we do something with that suffering that so somehow that suffering helps us be a better person, a better spouse, a better person in the community? So I've now kind of shifted this idea of suffering to it'll just go away to what can we do about it? Because I can tell you the worst thing to tell somebody when they're going through a really bad divorce is, don't worry, it'll just go away. Not very helpful. Not a good use of skillful means, if you will. Yeah, thanks a lot, right? So if we're all here, we also believe, I hope, well, I guess, that the kind of the antidote is the Eightfold Path. That's the last of the Four Noble Truths. How to relieve suffering is to follow the Eightfold Path. Now, in my deep dive into suffering lately, I've come to add two more. I'm not going to add them as 9 and 10, but maybe they might fit into other categories too. A couple of things I would, along with the traditional Eightfold Path, but right time, right living, or right time, or timing rather. So, if somebody's suffering, when's the right time to say what? There's no formula for that. It's just kind of a feel. When do you sense that somebody's suffering? When do you sense that somebody needs a hug? When do you sense that somebody just needs somebody to talk to? And then right resources. I'm married to a social worker, so I know all about resources. And so resources are invaluable. And maybe these two fit somewhere along the lines of, the Sangha or Upaya, skillful means. So in this session, we will undoubtedly experience suffering. But I think what it builds is resilience. If we keep at it, we keep going, we can see that change is inevitable, and diminishing suffering that we experience is possible. So we're all here for the same reasons, I think. But not only for ourselves, but again, for our family, our friends, and our community. And I'll say just on a personal note, if someone needs assistance during the session, if somebody's having a really hard time, I have been there and am still there at times. During that period of the divorce, I thought it would be a good idea to do a Rahatsu session one time, just a few months afterwards. And that wasn't the best use of my judgment. Oh, that was awful. Too soon. Timing, right? But I'll say if anyone is really struggling here, I empathize. If anyone needs any assistance, feel free to come and seek me out. As a friend and as the assistant to the Jisha. So I offer myself. So I was getting ready to close, but I want to make sure that under no uncertain terms do I leave out how wonderful my wife is. We all have people who've sacrificed for us and support us in this practice. And as they say these days, a shout out to my wife. But please join me this remaining few days of the session to, as Joshu said, awakening your mind and seeing your nature. Thank you.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.